Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi.
Brian Brushwood.
Yo, yo, yo.
So on After Things, what we like to do is talk to people about being a creative, creating a business, how to figure out the balance between the creative side and the business side, offer, thoughts from our own experiences. I think that we've all done some different things and some had some success and huge, huge humiliating failures. I mean, just horrifying ones. Make you want to curl under your covers in the back of your closet, never go face the world again while you cry incessantly.
Sure. Dude, you're not kidding. That's accurate. And, you know, that's one of the things is, the cliches, of course, that are 100% true are if you want to double your success rate, double your failure rate, fail faster, fail smarter, all that stuff. But I guess the weird part is if there's one ability that I think is the most valuable, you know, when you strike out on your own with any venture is being comfortable, being uncomfortable, man. Like if you can face your biggest fear and have the worst possible thing happen and come out the other side being all like, right on. Well, that's as bad as that's ever going to get. Let me, I learned a lot from that and I'll never make that mistake again. Let's go again. It's the ability to hop back on that ride every single morning that, that is the most difficult thing to achieve.
Absolutely. I would say the number one predictor of success of friends is how quickly they get back on track and go try something again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also understanding, in my opinion, you know, what your lessons are. And I think that's very often where your paralyzing fear of failure kind of comes in, is not necessarily that things are over, because, you know, failure is failure. It's like a Band-Aid, you know, on some level, like, you know, the fear of failure is almost worse than failing. Like, because once you failed, you're now by definition kind of on the other side of it, and you can, you know, rebuild and do something different. I think a lot of the paralysis after failure comes in not understanding, well, what did I learn? Or if you do have a sense of what you learned, but it contradicts something that you have long held to be true, whether that be a person or a practice or something like that, then that's hard to learn. It's hard to apply. And I think that's where a lot of that paralysis, at least in my mind, comes from.
Well, go ahead.
I think that the best advice I try to give myself is that sometimes it doesn't work out because it's just statistically, it wasn't your chance, wasn't your shot. You know, I look at trying to get on TV for years and, you know, did every 2 years ended up doing a pilot or something, which told me, okay, I know that the industry says, yes, we want to figure out how to find a place for you. And then, you know, it took forever to finally get onto TV, but at least I knew that something was working and it was waiting for the math to work out in my favor. But other things, you know, you want to go develop skills as you're waiting for these things to pan out. And that was sort of my attitude, was keep going up to bat and then keep developing skills. Because maybe it's not a lack of skills, it's just a numbers game. But either way, if every time you're trying it, if you evolve with that, then your chances are going to get better.
Well, and literally with television, that's certainly the case, because, you know, you can be in the room and pitching something amazing and somebody loves it, but it doesn't happen. But then that person's at another network, or there's a leadership change at the network when you go there with something else. And now someone's saying, oh, God, oh, man, we had this, like, you know, remember last time, the last regime, what idiots they were that we didn't go with this. Now you're here. Now it's great. Like in that particular field, like, you know, just running yourself against the rocks over and over and over again is literally the only way to succeed.
Well, and it certainly doesn't hurt to put yourself in a position where you're highly diversified with other interests and other mechanics, because holy cow, is television a slow moving glacier?
Well, that's a sanity thing, right? Like that's just being able to go to sleep at night, is like being able to busy yourself with different stuff. And, idle hands are the devil's, plaything, workplace.
Yeah.
I always think that that applies to a lot of things in publishing, is that, you know, with HarperCollins, I'm working on the third novel, and if that's, they're happy with that, that'll be a fourth one, but it'll be a year and a half or more from now. And so, you know, the idea is eventually that, you know, I reach some sort of, you know, critical mass, but that could be 10 years from now.
Yeah.
Of doing everything I'm supposed to do is just keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. And that's true of a lot of things. But, you know, there's a keep going up to bat and keep trying to evolve. And I think that it may not be because you didn't have a skill set, but always assume that you could have better skills.
Yeah. And also, I guess that's the other thing is the whole act of assumption. I think that if there's one general attitude that I think has worked out pretty well for all three of us, as best I could tell, is not issuing polemics on what we know is the right way to do a thing, but rather to say, we strongly suspect this is going to be a good idea, or this, you know, and then you know, responding to the evidence that you get. There was a person I used to work with years and years and years ago, where ultimately. It was very interesting to see, and I understand why people do it, but I was a very big fan of hey, let's get – no, this routine is not where we want it to be. Let's go out, get in front of people and be terrible and learn as fast as we can and figure out which parts of it are good and which parts of it are bad and where our natural gifts are, and maybe we'll stumble into some kind of theme in there that will eventually become, you know, a piece of really good theater. And what ended up breaking everything down was ultimately, you know, every time I would bring this up, this person would talk about like, no, well, you really need to have this one particular type of satin curtain to really do this. I mean, if you're going to do it right, and I only want to do it right. If we're going to do this, I only want to do it and do it the right way. And you know, I have these curtains, but they're just in my home state. And you know, I'll be there in a couple months. I'll pick them up, and then we can really do this right. And ultimately, I just realized that I was in a relationship where he wanted to be right, and I wanted to make money, and the two of those things were not always going to be compatible. And so ultimately I, you know, split with this person just so I could do a much more iterative, you know, going off. Not that it's necessarily the best way to do it, but, you know, I'd rather get up and be bad and learn quickly than sit around and be right and have nobody ever see anything.
And your partnership magic show with your daughter, Penny, has never been the same.
That person was Justin Robert Young.
Well, I mean, listen, there's... Just, I mean, I don't know. And these very often kind of sounds like, you know, empty stuff you'd put on a tea towel. But like, ain't no substitute for just going out and doing it, even if you're going to eat it in front of people, man.
Well, I'd say especially, right? That has to be part of the plan is at some point, like when you sit down at 20 years old and you lay out the 45-year-old plan or 45-year plan, you have to write in there, yeah, along the way, there are going to be some epic stories of failure and embarrassment and things that didn't go according to plan and lessons that were learned. Like in my imagination, before I even started, I had, you know, I'd interview people who I, you know, worship the ground they walked on, you know, like Teller or David Copperfield or any of the great magicians.
And
Andrew Main, and in my imagination, I asked them, hey, have you ever had a show go terribly bad? And then whatever was about to come out of their mouth, I knew would be so much more terrifying and epic a story than I had experienced yet. So I knew that if I wanted to be as good as they were, I needed to set myself up for similar situations. Not that I'm aiming for failure, but just that it's you don't get to success and not have awesome, rad stories of difficult challenges thrown in your way.
Oh my God, of course.
Yeah. Can you clarify something there, O'Brien? I thought you said, in my imagination, I asked them this.
Oh, no.
Okay,
you don't exist. No, I'm talking about like at the age of 25, before you and I had ever met, when I considered quitting my day job and considered the path that I was signing up for. You know, it's like, okay, where am I? What have I done? What's the hardest gig I've ever had? I'm like, these are all chump change compared to the stories I bet these other guys have.
Wow, okay, so it did sound like you're having conversations with them in your head.
Oh, yeah. Imaginary. Like you. Much like you.
Clarify. Yeah. Clarify.
Well, no, isn't that the I don't know if this is true or not, but I'd heard it was like a Buddhist technique of when you have a problem. Zen Buddhist technique is when you have a problem, you try to remember how you solved it, as if, you know, there's a version of you in the future. Like, oh yeah, how did I get out of this room filling with water and I'm about to drown? And then it's you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm actually a big fan of you know, theory of mind and trying to develop models of how other people function or do things, because you find sometimes you can have the answer if you say, okay, who's your smartest friend? How would they solve this problem? And you would say, oh, well, you know, he would go into Reddit and put it in front of everybody and say, hey, who's got the answer to do this? Which these answers wouldn't be readily available to us because maybe they're slightly outside our comfort zone. Mm-hmm. But often that's it, is that it might be, oh, no, I would just call up the smartest person I know, ask them who's the smartest person they know, and then, you know, within 30 minutes I'll get an answer. And so there's either like just trying to figure out what you know about how other people solve problems and putting yourself in their point of view. And then there's, you know, modeling, and then there's actually saying, oh, this is how they'll do it. Let me go do that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And ultimately it's like, that's something that I've had to work on is getting like, I'm very, very lucky to have a lot of very, very smart people that I can bounce stuff off of, but learning how to ask the right questions has been something that I've had to work on. And I often want to go to people with kind of half-baked questions that ultimately aren't going to get me where I want. I need to know exactly what I want before I seek out the help that I need. And that's, you know, everybody's got a process.
That's sort of very poignant, is that the idea of how you frame that question of what it is you're trying to solve. I know all the time in writing or other creative things, I get stumped because I don't know what I'm asking. I know that something's not working, but I have to back up and say, oh, what's the problem here? And is it that I don't know where the story should go, I don't know where the character should go, or if I'm trying to think of something, you have to narrow down specifically what problem you're trying to solve. And once you define a problem as narrowly as you can, the solution is obvious.
Yeah.
Right, so I think we fixed everyone's problems. Everyone's
done.
A success.
So, yeah.
To avoid another podcast like this one, people, send in your questions. Send in what you want us to try to ponder or answer, because really, it's on you guys. It's on you. That's not Brian, not Justin.
Are they emailing Neshcom directly? Yeah. Is that correct?
Email neshcom@gmail, neshcom@gmail.com.
Awesome.
Subject line after things.
This has been great.
Hey, so I don't know if we could do like double picks, but I have been playing a bit of Overwatch, and man, talk about a project that is so good precisely because they identified everything wrong with it in early stages. You probably know better than me, Neshcom. This was originally, this world was being built for kind of an MMO kind of situation, and that they just bailed on that.
Yeah, I think Blizzard was spending a lot of time on figuring out lore and story, and I guess either they couldn't make it work or it just wasn't what they wanted it to be. It was going to be called Epic or something like that.
Yeah, the story, as I heard it, was like basically you had a day job, and every so often, you know, you'd get called into your duties on the Overwatch, and you become a badass for a bit. Yeah. And without ever having seen it or guessing, I'm going to guess half the game was really good, and then the rest
Kotaku,
of the time you're just...
Kotaku had the big autopsy on what was internally referred to as Project Titan, and this was a decade in the making. And they Kotaku put it back up on the front, on their front page, because they launched Overwatch. But yeah, that goes very much into exactly what it was supposed to do. So here I go. Players would be able to select from classes with names like Reaper, Jumper, Titan, Ranger, and Juggernaut, each of which had its own special combat abilities and items. According to a source, Jumpers, for example, would be agile scouts. Yada yada yada. It felt a lot like Team Fortress and a cross between StarCraft II's in-game cinematics and The Incredibles. So certainly a lot of the elements that make Overwatch very, very special were spawned from this project. However, the idea of splitting the MMO into, quote, real world and shadow worlds has been abandoned for what we presume to be the more interesting Shadow World.
You can definitely see in like the cinematics and all the story and the lore, it's very clear that there are two distinct good guys and bad guy teams. But those don't have any, that's all just narrative. That doesn't play into how the game works at all. But I think it's better for that. I think it's better that you there is not any sort of weird limitation or bounding box on that. I think what they've made is a really good game.
Well, and this was also, I mean, listen, you want to talk about just creativity in general. Blizzard is a company that, you know, saw declining subscription numbers for their cash cow, World of Warcraft, right? That's what made them not just a game developer, but like a very, very, very titanic force in their industry. They were developing Project Titan as what was being heralded as the next MMO. Like everybody who had done subscription MMOs and everybody had tried it every which way but loose. Free to play, licensing gigantic properties like Star Wars, and all of which had varying successes, you know, going from middling to unsuccessful. Project Titan was supposed to be the next 20 years of MMOs. So it not only was it important internally, it was important for the entire genre. And they pulled the plug on it probably within, they were at like a you know, pooper get off the pot situation. And they just decided to slash it in half and release half the game because the other half of the game wasn't fun enough. That takes nuts, man. Like that is something that is rare leadership to say, hey, you want to know what this thing that we have developed for a really, 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 really long time? It's just not going to see the light of day.
Man, well, that's a tough one. That's a tough pill to swallow.
I got a side jag if we got a few minutes.
Yeah, sure.
So this week we had the Angry Birds movie.
Yep.
Right? And currently it's at 66 million. It's doing pretty good overseas. It is now the number 5 highest grossing video game movie of all time. The number 1 being Lara Croft. We'll go by domestic. Lara Croft is number 1 at 131 million. Number 2 is Prince of Persia at 90. Then Pokemon at 85. Mortal Kombat at 70. And wow. We are facing, we're going to get the Warcraft movie, which Vance, word on that.
Not great.
Yeah. No, it's not so good, Al.
Yeah, it's shocking how poorly video games in general have been able to cross over into video games. I believe at some point, well, certainly at some point, but like I think the Final Fantasy movie was with like a B- grade was the highest rated video game movie of all time or something. Like it's astonishing how low the bar is for quality of movies.
Yeah. Now it's funny. Everybody loves Duncan Jones. We all love Duncan Jones.
Yes.
And I don't think he'll take too much of a hit from this. And again, it may come out and it may do great, you know, may do fantastic, but you know,
look at these Rotten Tomato ratings. If you go to the Wikipedia listing of list of films based on video games, we got a ton of them coming out up ahead. Assassin's Creed, Resident Evil, Final Chapter, Uncharted, Sonic the Hedgehog, Sky Cooper, Dragon Slayer, the movie. I didn't know that was coming. But then, Final Fantasy got, 85 million and 44% on Rotten Tomatoes. Angry Birds movie currently at 43% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it looks like it's already at $223 million. That's amazing.
Internationally, yeah.
Yeah, international.
So listen, these movies are not good, right? Like, I that's not to say that they will not be, they'll be bad forever, right? I mean, you could say a lot of the same stuff about comic book movies in the early 90s, right? And then, you know, it took Blade and X-Men.
That we had a great Superman movie in 1978.
Yeah, oh, true, yeah.
You know, we had a great Superman 2, maybe even a better, you know, a wonderful sequel, perfect for its time. The Tim Burton movies, I wasn't, you know, at the time I was cool with them, but first couple did great box office and actually got some strong reviews, I would say that comic book movies, you know,
You're right.
Yeah. So I have my theory is it's the inherent problem is that what makes a great video game is the lack of a narrative. There is a great story. There's a great premise. There's story building. There's the story, background story around you, the universe you create. But the fun of the game is your experience in there. You're set in this world in which you can have a great experience in a narrative and discover things and do that. And none of that necessarily and a personality, you know, is at it's your personality, where the central thing to any story is great characters. And character is a very different thing in the film world than it is in a video game world. And it's not to put one form over the other, because they absolutely have their incredible strengths. Well, world building is absolutely essential in video games. You create a great video game world, you'll spend 30, 40 hours in there.
You know, and I think what's so frustrating, you know, and it'll be very interesting to talk to a lot of my super, super hardcore Warcraft fans, friends in 3 months than now, right? Because right now, nobody's going to talk crap about the movie as soon as it comes out, because everybody, you know, wants to, you know, be a part of
a little bit of a Phantom Menace syndrome happening right now, where it's like,
I think it's like, it's people want more, even if they're just disappointed by this movie, they want it to be a hit because maybe the next one will be better, right?
Right.
But I think what for me, with only a passing understanding of this lore, it thinks is a missed opportunity is that, unlike, let's say, an Uncharted or an Assassin's Creed, where people are very excited about a fairly static storyline, Warcraft is very much like, I mean, it is closer to me like the Lego movie, right? Like, you can do something that kind of goes into various different places that involves these pieces, because that's part of the fun of Warcraft the game is the infinite possibilities. So you can tell a story that isn't just this, like, very laborious epic lore, like, and through the portal came the hordes, and now if we don't unite, then we will all perish. Like, it's been done a million times. I mean, Warcraft as a lore very much borrows from other high fantasy, so you're not getting anything necessarily completely unique. What was fun about Warcraft, as I understand it, is how silly it is, and how much you can tell almost not a parody, but a more lighthearted version of these stories that right now I think are kind of ripe for it.
Yeah, dude, I would much rather. I mean, I probably will not go see the Warcraft movie, but I would not have missed a Warcraft movie if it was essentially a fraternity story told with goblins, you know, like at Goblin, we're going to get that crusty old Dean or whatever. I would have loved that.
Yeah. And, you know, the fact that it's not that, and the fact that, you know, I think there's a reason why it's just like nobody is going to walk in to a Warcraft movie except for people who are already invested in it and take that lore seriously. It's just not going to happen. And if the movie takes itself seriously, I think that's a fatal flaw right there.
I think that, as we saw the declining box office of the Hobbit movies, and then by the time the Warcraft trailer came out, it's like, oh, okay, you know, the benchmark was Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, but even that, there was a fatigue with the Hobbit because the story wasn't that strong, and the building these big universe stories, give us personal, dial it down, make it small, and you'll be amazed at how well that will go over. Where, you know, like, there's invading armies of CG. I mean, all looks just so CG. I'm looking at, like, vampire, you know, Shrek meets The Rock.
Yeah.
You know, characters. It's just like, none of that looks real to me. It's a cartoon movie, and I have a problem there with that. And then, two, the story, like, it's so important. Our world is in danger. It always is, you know.
So,
and also, like, what do we care if they get overrun by orcs?
So the highest rated Rotten Tomatoes video game movie of all time at 44% is that Final Fantasy The Spirits Within. Angry Birds is number 2 with 43%. Metacritic, though, what do you think the top Metacritic video game movie of all time is?
Super Mario Brothers.
Mortal Kombat. Yeah.
I got
Mortal Kombat at 58%.
It was
Man,
great.
I'll tell you what. Mortal Kombat was I dug the crap out of Mortal Kombat when I was a kid. I liked it. I mean, obviously I was very much into the game. I don't know. I mean, it's ultimately I do believe that you can make a good movie out of anything. But it is going to be dependent on the story that you tell. And I think for a lot of these properties, we don't, even people who love the video games, if you get why it's fun at its core and be true to it, you don't need to you know, slobber all over the fan service of like, oh my God, he pulled out the sword and they went to the town and there's a Murloc that popped up in the swamp. Like, that's, you know, that's sprinkling on top.
The problem is, like, I keep trying to say it, it's like Deadpool was great because they took this great character and they said, let's be true to that. Captain America, you know, let's do the best version of these characters and put them there. Video games, you're the character. So when they buy this IP, it's missing the most important ingredient to a great story.
Yeah.
Or either that or it places someone else who, because that's a really good point. It's like somebody else is playing, Gordon Freeman on Half-Life. You're like, well, that's not how I played the role. When I was Gordon Freeman, I took a lot more creativity to the way I set up my traps. And, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because a lot of times some of the most popular video games are they're a derivative of really popular film franchises. You know, Lara Croft did pretty well as a franchise, but it was because it's Lady Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
And you had, you know, the attempts to do like, you know, Duke Nukem was funny because, you know, as a game, because it was Ash from Evil Dead.
Correct. Yeah, complete with full-on lifted lines. All the lines were him. And by the way, that's the kind of person Duke Nukem would be, is he would unironically go around pinching lines from movies he likes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I hold hope that there could be some people like I watched the Assassin's Creed trailer. I'm like, man, this again.
Yeah, we'll see.
I want to be wrong.
Can we? All right, real quick, just a few lines. Big kerfuffle this week about Captain America, the Steve Rogers comic, wherein it was revealed that at least in this first issue. Who knows whether or not they'll retcon it or have some big left turn. It'll be the first time in comics history that ever happens. That he is a Hydra agent and murders somebody. A lot of people up in arms about it. I have a hot take. Did you guys follow this? And do you have an opinion on it?
Yeah, I mean, as I understand it, this was you said it was the first issue
first issue of a new series, Steve Rogers : Captain America.
Yeah, they indicated in some quote that they had been setting it up literally for years with a bunch of little things, and it's like, look, yeah, this is what you do. You set up an arc, you play, you know, you make Superman dead for a little bit, and then, you know, you give Spider-Man organic web shooters for a little bit, and then he has a twin, and it turns out that his clone was the real him and we've been following the wrong way. Yeah, hello, people, comic books. I'd like you to meet them.
I here's my problem. I can only think of one time ever that they did a big thing like that, and it really was ended up being interesting narratively. Every other time, back in the early night, like they did the first time they killed off Superman, and then, you know, we were going to get the big John Byrne, you know, reimagining of it, and ended up being the same dumb Superman. There, it just over and over again. The only time I ever thought something was really done well, because for a period of time it created interesting consequences, and you knew it would get better. But what was it going to be like when it happened? Was when Bane broke Batman's back.
Yeah,
because you're like, okay, we know Batman's going to get better, but what's going to happen to Gotham while this is real? This is a very interesting. Who's going to step into place there? You know. What's that going to occur? And that's what the Azrael storyline. And that was a very interesting storyline that Christopher Nolan decided to use elements of that in the last Batman movie, because it was this really, this is an interesting consequence. And nobody for a moment thinks that, oh, what if Captain America really was working? That's dumb. I'm not even going to pick up your comic because of that. That's so dumb.
Well, I think that's that to me is its greatest sin. It's not necessarily that it's, you know, this inherently, you know, awful thing. How could you possibly do it? Now Captain America being a Hydra agent ruins my childhood, yada, yada, yada. It's just the most fun stories I've ever been a part of, I think, comes from the fact that you start trying to think about where we are. Right. And where we're going. And when you can in your own head think, oh, wait, but what if he does this? And but what if this does that? Oh, but what if this character has this happen to them? And you can think of multiple things in your head that would be exciting. And now you're excited to see where they take it, because maybe it's one of those, or maybe it's another door number X that is more exciting than everything else. Those are the best ones. When you look at Captain America as a Hydra double agent, it's like, okay, well, either this is a fake memory or he's an elaborate double-double agent and he's finally going to give Hydra the what for, or he's really a Hydra agent and now we're going to find out why he really becomes Captain America. None of these seem like really exciting pathways for me to follow.
Again, it's a dumb retcon kind of thing. If you were to do one like, hey, let's send Captain America to prison, like, you know, for a year or something, a federal pen or something like that, or some aspect like that, or, you know, they've done criminal storylines and stuff, or like, I mean, something like that right now. Oh, going forward, this is, I mean, they did the thing where he, like, you know, kind of turned his back on America in sort of a weird way. And, you know, there have been attempts at stuff like that. But I think if you tried to say, how do you really seriously approach this? I think there could be more interesting ways to then, like, well, oh, here's the thing you didn't know.
That's the thing, is like when he gave up the America part of his name and he was just like, you know what, anyone else, I'm just the captain, don't worry about it. And he goes to Tony Stark and gets a thing made, a new shield and so on. Like, that was great because that kind of tapped into this cultural gestalt where it's like, hey, man, yeah, I'm not real proud of the way America's acting these days. And I, wow, how interesting that this guy who's, you know, was a cheerleader clown for America is finally turning his back. And what's that like? I mean, whether you agreed with it or not, it was something that it resonated. I don't know what this would resonate with. I don't know that anybody felt anything good about this.
It's just like, you know, like, but what if the president was really the president of Nazis?
Well, and again, like, that's what made Watchmen great, was because it was in the height of, you know, written in the 1980s, at the height of the threat of global destruction, and it was something that tapped into all this. Where's this?
I got to run, gentlemen. Right. I'm going to say, any of you can say that it's been after and keep it going, but
nah, I think we agree.
Hail Hydra. All right.
Been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.